Welcome to today's deep dive. Today we were looking at something pretty rare.
Yeah, extremely rare.
We got our hands on this set of unfiltered, totally private executive coaching notes.
Right, which you just never see.
Never. It's an internal document, essentially a masterclass in self-interrogation, directed at a highly successful professional. And the mission for today's deep dive is to unpack these raw insights about career blind spots.
Exactly.
We are going to explore this incredibly difficult transition from being a high-level operator, the person who gets things done,
Right.
to becoming a system architect, the person who designs how things get done.
Which is a massive leap.
Huge. And most importantly, we want to help you, the listener, identify where your own hard-earned competence might actually be the very thing holding you back. Because whether you are actively prepping for a major career shift, or you're just trying to understand why your current success sometimes feels a little, I don't know, hollow.
Yeah, thin.
Yeah, exactly. These notes offer a pretty sobering blueprint for figuring out what comes next.
It is so unusual to see the unvarnished truth of what it takes to operate at the absolute highest levels and really the psychological toll that transition takes.
Yeah, really.
Because high performers, they almost always hit a wall eventually, and it's rarely because they lack skills or drive.
Right, it's not a competence issue.
No, not at all. They hit that wall because their internal alignment breaks down. They outgrow their own success. I like to think of this transition as trying to completely remodel a house while you are still actively living inside it.
Well, that's a great way to put it.
Right. You are trying to build the new architecture, but you still have to cook dinner in the kitchen every night. It requires a complete rewiring of how you view your own value.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the very first revelation in this text really sets the stage. The notes point out a massive trap for this individual, the trap of misalignment.
Yeah.
The subject of these notes is deeply driven by what the text calls internal coherence, which basically means having their daily work perfectly aligned with their deepest understanding of how the world operates.
But in reality,
Right, in reality, they keep stepping into systems and roles that reward visible output, fancy titles, and optics.
and that mismatch is quiet, but it is deeply destructive over time.
How so?
Well, because from the outside, this individual is crushing it. It looks like absolute success. The promotions are there, the praise from the board is there. But internally, the text says it feels thin.
Vin.
And what happens is the person misinterprets that thin, hollow feeling as simple restlessness. They think, oh, I just need a new project or I just need a
I
vacation.
just need a break.
Exactly. But it is actually a fundamental structural misalignment between what they value and what they are spending their days doing. The system they are in is feeding their ego, but starving their intellect.
So to fix this, the text gives an incredibly specific, actionable mandate. It tells the subject they have to protect a strict 60-minute block every single day for only work I can do.
Only work I can do.
It gives examples like writing to clarify complex thoughts, designing new operating models, or deep thinking on a problem with real long-term consequences. The notes bluntly state, if you cannot protect 1 hour for the work only you can do, the system owns you.
That is so powerful.
And there is even a specific deadline written in the notes. By March 11, 2026, the subject has to revisit this calendar block and add a second protected hour.
It's about taking back agency from the machine. If you are just reacting to emails and Slack messages all day, you aren't an architect. You are just a router for other people's emergencies.
I hear that, but let me play devil's advocate for a second.
Go for it.
If I just start blocking off my calendar, ignoring my boss's immediate requests, and telling my team I'm doing deep thinking,
You're gonna get fired.
exactly, I'm probably going to get fired. So how does this actually apply to someone listening right now who isn't already at the top of the food chain and calling all their own shots?
That is a very fair point. You can't just flip a switch and ignore your responsibilities, but the core principle scales to any level. If you can't protect 60 minutes, can you protect 15 minutes before you open your inbox?
Okay.
Can you protect one lunch hour a week to zoom out and look at the systems you are working within rather than just the tasks?
Start small.
Exactly. It's about building the muscle of boundary setting. And honestly, getting that time back is usually complicated by another major issue the notes reveal, which revolves around the burden of competence.
This part fascinated me
Yeah.
because the subject truly believes they walk into a room and come across as approachable, scrappy, and collaborative. But the direct feedback from the notes is that their colleagues actually experience them as incredibly fast, intense, and always 3 moves ahead.
What's fascinating here is the ripple effect of that intimidating competence. It is a very common dynamic.
Oh, totally.
Think of it like being the only person in the house who knows how to load the dishwasher perfectly.
I know that feeling.
Right. Eventually, everyone else just stops trying and leaves their dirty plates in the sink for you to handle. When you are always three moves ahead in a meeting, you accidentally train your team to just wait for your answer. You intimidate people into deferring to you rather than engaging with you.
Wow.
And the subject was reading this lack of pushback from their team as a lack of strategic depth. But the reality, it was just hesitation. People don't want to challenge someone who always seems so absolutely certain.
And ultimately, that robs the highly competent person of the strategic friction they desperately need to test their own ideas.
Yeah.
They're living in an echo chamber of their own competence.
Precisely. You need people to poke holes in your models, but they won't do that if you present every idea as a flawless, finished product.
The text actually offers a brilliant tactical fix for this. It advises this leader to deliberately delay their best insight.
Hold it back.
Yeah. It says, during the first third of any meeting, do not reveal your cleanest framing of the problem. Instead, ask questions like, what feels most unclear right now? Or where do you think this plan breaks?
It forces engagement.
Right. I especially love the advice to dial back outward conviction. The notes tell the subject, if you are 80% sure of something, do not speak to the room like you are 95% sure.
Yeah.
You have to explicitly state, this is my current model, not a conclusion. You have to invite your team into the uncertainty with you.
That takes immense discipline.
Oh, I bet.
Because when your entire career, your entire professional identity has been built on having the right answers quickly, holding those answers back feels like you are failing at your job.
Yeah.
You feel like you are letting people down, which flows right into the struggle of misunderstanding your true competitive edge.
Exactly. The subject believes, down to their core, that their edge is their ability to execute. They pride themselves on getting their hands dirty.
Right.
But the notes violently correct this assumption. The text points out that execution used to be their edge, but not anymore. Now their real edge is pattern recognition and judgment.
This is the classic trap for high-level operators. There is a profound danger in jumping in to solve problems that others should really be metabolizing themselves.
Metabolizing. I like that word.
It fits perfectly because when you jump in and fix things out of habit, you make yourself completely indispensable in the short term because you are the hero saving the day, but you make yourself invisible in the long term because you are trapped in the weeds instead of steering the ship. You are fixing the plumbing while the house is burning down.
So to break that habit of jumping in, the notes introduce a 30-day challenge called the no default yes rule.
Right.
For any new work that comes across their desk, the default answer has to be, let me think about whether this is the right use of my attention. And when they feel that overwhelming itch to fix a broken process, they are instructed to pause and ask themselves, if I disappear tomorrow, how would this get solved?
It's a great question.
But again, let me push back a little. Isn't asking how would this get solved if I disappeared just a fancy corporate way of passing the buck? It sounds a bit like abandoning your team when things get hard.
It can look like that if done poorly, absolutely. But there is a massive difference between shirking your duty and intentionally empowering your team.
Okay.
Passing the buck is ignoring a problem because you don't want to deal with it. Asking how would this get solved without me is about recognizing that your constant intervention is actually an organizational bottleneck.
Ah, I see.
If the team literally cannot function without you stepping in to save the day, you haven't built a resilient system. You've just built a cult of personality around your own competence.
Here's where it gets really interesting. That realization forces a very uncomfortable look in the mirror about how we view our own endurance. The notes make a profound distinction that I think will resonate with so many of you listening.
Yeah.
The subject thinks they have been incredibly patient in their career waiting for the right opportunities, but the text sharply clarifies that they are not being patient at all.
Right.
They are actually just being tolerant.
That distinction is everything. Let's really break that down.
Please do.
Patience is an active strategic state. It is waiting for the exact right moment to strike or allowing a complex project the time it needs to mature. Tolerance, on the other hand, is passive. Tolerance is staying way longer than you should in situations that no longer compound your growth or serve your goals.
And people do this all the time.
All the time. High performers often justify this tolerance by calling it loyalty to the company or saying they are just keeping their options open. But underneath, it is really just a reluctance to close a door until there is a crystal clear, guaranteed open door right next to it.
And that reluctance to close a door without a safety net ties directly into how this person views risk. It's funny, the notes observe that the subject is perfectly willing to take physical risks in sports, and they take massive intellectual risks all the time.
But
they are terrified of identity risk. They fiercely protect the version of themselves that the world currently sees as reliable, competent, and respected.
And this is the crux of the entire transition. The next chapter of this person's career actively requires them to risk being temporarily misunderstood. They have to risk becoming non-obvious to the people around them.
Right.
The notes use a highly specific example regarding a memo the subject wrote about GLP-1s.
Right. And just to clarify for everyone, GLP-1s are that new class of highly popular weight loss and diabetes drugs, things like Ozempic.
Right.
But the subject isn't writing a medical paper. They're looking at how these drugs will radically alter consumer behavior, healthcare systems, and the economy. They are viewing pharmacology through the lens of system architecture.
Exactly. They are applying pattern recognition. But the feedback on their memo was that the draft was way too polished. It read like finished definitive thinking.
Which is their old habit.
Exactly. The notes tell the subject it needs to be 20 to 30% shorter, quite a bit rougher, and explicitly framed as how I am currently seeing this rather than a bulletproof argument. They have to show their messy work in public, which is terrifying for someone whose identity is wrapped up in being the person with the perfect answers.
Because showing that messy work is the only way to align with their massive overarching goal, which the notes call the 10-year arc.
Yes.
The subject's new 10-year thesis is mapped out right here in the text, designing and articulating how intelligent systems should be built so they increase human agency rather than replace it.
It's ambitious.
Very. And the notes point out that this specific pattern recognition applies across everything they care about. AI agents, e-commerce, and those GLP-1 healthcare shifts we just mentioned.
But to pursue that 10-year arc, the identity fundamentally has to shift. They can no longer be the product leader who thinks deeply. They must become the system architect who occasionally operates.
That is a completely different value proposition to the market.
Totally different.
And making that shift requires confronting the lies we tell ourselves to stay comfortable. The text literally lists out the lies the subject uses to avoid facing the truth.
This part is brutal.
It really is. Lie number two is, I can do both. It is the belief that you can be the high-level visionary architect. Andy, the daily in the weeds operator.
Right.
The notes say, sure, you have the intellectual capability to do both, but splitting your force just delays the category shift.
It dilutes your impact. You are half building the new house while still half cooking in the old kitchen. It doesn't work.
Then there is lie number six. If it's right, it will feel obvious. The reality the text points out is that it absolutely won't feel obvious. It will feel exposed and highly risky.
Yeah.
The notes mention their MCP and GEO bets and examples of this. And while we won't get bogged down in the deep technicals of those specific acronyms, think of them as highly speculative public-facing initiatives. The subject is putting their reputation on the line with these bets before the market has proven them right.
Which leads directly to lie number nine, the deepest and most painful one.
Yeah.
If I fully step into this architect identity, I might lose relevance.
That's the big fear.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what we're really talking about is the fear of entering the valley of misclassification.
The valley of misclassification.
Every high performer fears this valley. You have spent years, maybe decades, building up what the text calls competence capital. You are known, respected, and highly compensated as the person who gets things done.
Let's translate that for a second. The valley of misclassification is basically that terrifying middle ground where you've stopped doing your old job, but no one quite trusts you to do your new job yet. So everyone around you is just confused by what you are actually contributing.
That is exactly it. Stepping into a new paradigm means you lose that immediate daily validation. For a time, people won't know exactly what to do with you or what box to put you in.
Right.
You have to endure that valley of misclassification, that period of being misunderstood, to reach the heights of being a true system architect. You have to be okay with people thinking you've lost your edge while you are actually just forging a new one.
So how do you actually cross that valley without losing your mind? The fourth section of these notes gives the tactical playbook, and it is entirely centered on radical subtraction.
Radical subtraction.
The mandate from the text is uncompromising. Kill 30% of your surface area in the next 90 days. Not delegate it. Kill it. If a project or meeting doesn't build the architect identity, it goes.
It's ruthless.
The notes tell the subject to leave Slack channels entirely, to outright ignore certain operational escalations. There is a specific mention to stop responding to Salesforce escalations and to drop all execution-heavy commitments.
Yeah.
Again, playing devil's advocate, killing 30% of your responsibilities sounds like a fantastic way to drop major balls and let your team down.
It does, which is why you cannot just slowly back away from execution or ghost your team. You have to explicitly sever the ties and move upstream of decisions.
Meaning what?
That means having very uncomfortable, transparent negotiations with your peers. You have to look at them and say, I am no longer here to manage the daily workflow. I am here to manage the problem framing, to articulate the trade-offs, and to maintain decision hygiene. You have to redefine the rules of engagement, otherwise they will just keep pulling you back into the weeds.
And with all that freed up time, the mandate is to build architecture, not just content. The text makes a really sharp distinction between writing posts, like a standard blog or a quick thought piece, and building architecture.
This is crucial.
The notes list 5 specific traits that define true architecture. 1, it has a clear name. 2, it has structured components. 3, it contains inherent tension or trade-offs. 4, it applies across multiple domains, not just one specific industry. And 5, it evolves over time based on feedback.
The notes give a phenomenal example of this using something called AngelCon.
Right.
Now, if the subject treats AngelCon as just another startup investment or a standard networking event, it is simply portfolio diversification. It's just a transaction.
Oh.
But if they use AngelCon deliberately to develop a framework for evaluating early stage systems and use it to host structured public conversations about how startups can increase human agency, and then they document those patterns,
then it changes.
Suddenly it isn't an event anymore. It becomes architecture. It becomes a repeatable public model that visibly shifts their identity from operator to thinker.
To ensure they are actually staying on this new path and not slipping back into the comfortable dopamine hits of checking off daily tasks, the text demands they tighten their feedback loop.
Yeah.
There is this brilliant, incredibly simple question. The subject is instructed to ask a trusted peer named Sean every single quarter during their review. The question is, am I becoming more defined or more diffuse?
That is just incredible.
What a stunning way to hold yourself accountable to your own evolution. Are my edges getting sharper, or am I just bleeding into everyone else's problems? So what does this all mean? We've covered so much ground today, diving deep into the private struggles, the fears, and the strategies of an elite performer trying to remodel their career from the inside out. But the true value of this deep dive is turning that mirror back onto you.
Absolutely.
Where in your own life or your own career are you hiding behind execution? Are you jumping in to solve problems that your team, your peers, or even your family should really be metabolizing themselves just because it gives you that quick hit of feeling indispensable?
That dopamine hit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Are you confusing tolerance for patience, staying in a role that no longer compounds your growth simply because you were too scared to face the valley of misclassification?
Those are the exact right questions to be asking, because the ultimate synthesis of all these notes, of everything we have unpacked today, is that true leverage is never about doing more. It is not about optimizing your workflow to fit more tasks into a 24-hour day.
Definitely not.
True leverage is about actively deciding what not to do. It is about relentlessly narrating the why behind those decisions to the people around you. And finally, externalizing your internal model so the rest of the world can align with your thinking rather than you constantly bending backward to execute theirs.
Perfectly said.
This raises an important question, one that expands on everything we've talked about and challenges the very core of how we define a strong work ethic. The text notes that this individual is not afraid of hard work. In fact, they are perfectly comfortable with physical and cognitive strain. What they are actually terrified of is boredom.
Wow.
It makes you wonder. If you successfully make this transition, if you endure the valley, build the architecture, and create intelligent systems that run perfectly without your constant intervention, is the ultimate goal of high performance simply to make yourself entirely obsolete?
That's a scary thought.
And if you do make yourself obsolete to the daily grind, what are you going to do with the terrifying stillness that follows? Are you ready to let the noise burn off, or are you going to keep inventing emergencies just to feel needed?